29. Titus Chilcamata, the man Arcady had come to see, lived about 25 miles southwest of Cullen settlement, in a shanty beside a soakage. Apparently he was in such a foul mood that Arcady, who had been bracing himself for the ordeal, suggested I stay behind until he'd taken the temperature. He enlisted the support of Titus's manager, a soft-spoken man with a limp, and the nickname Limpy. The two of them set off in the Land Cruiser at 9. The day was very hot and windy, and there were scribbles of cirrus blowing across the sky. I walked over to the dispensary. The noise from the roof was deafening.
"They fix it at once," Estrella yelled. "Costed $2,000. Imagine!"
She was a tiny young woman with a very humorous face. I climbed up to inspect the damage. The job had been hopelessly botched. All the roof timbers were askew. In the not unforeseeable future, the building was going to collapse. Estrella sent me over to Don, the works manager, to ask him for a hammer and roofing nails.
"None of your business," he said, "or mine."
The work had been done by some shit artist from Alice. "That doesn't lessen the risk," I said facetiously, "of one suicidal Spanish nun, or a child cut in two when a sheet blows off." Don relented with bad grace and gave me all the nails he had. I spent a couple of hours hammering down the sheets, and when the job was done, Estrella smiled with approval.
"At least I can hear myself think now," she said.
On the way back from returning the hammer, I looked in on Rolf at the store. Nearby, sheltering from the wind behind a ring of empty drums, a party of men and women were playing poker for very high stakes. A man had lost $1,400 and was resigned to losing more. The winner, a giantess in a yellow jumper, was slapping her cards onto the ground sheets with the droop-mouthed, hungry expression of ladies at a casino. Rolf was still reading Proust. He had left the Duchesse de Guermantes dinner party and was following the Baron de Charlus through the streets to his apartment. He had a thermos of black coffee which he shared with me.
"I've got someone here you should meet," he said.
He handed a toffee to a small boy and told him to run and fetch Joshua. About 10 minutes later, a middle-aged man appeared in the doorway, all leg and less body, very dark-skinned in a black cowboy hat.
"Ha!" said Rolf. "Mr. Wayne himself."
"Boss," said the aboriginal, in a gravelly American accent.
"Listen, you old scrounger. This is a friend of mine from England. I want you to tell him about the dreamings."
"Boss," he repeated.
Joshua was a famous Pintupi performer who could always be counted on to give a good show. He had performed in Europe and the United States. On flying into Sydney for the first time, he mistook the ground lights for stars and asked why the plane was flying upside down. I followed him home along a winding path through the Spinifex. He had no hips to speak of, and his pants kept falling down to reveal a pair of neat, calloused buttocks. Home lay on the highest point of the saddle between Mount Cullen and Mount Liebler. It consisted of a gutted station wagon which Joshua had rolled onto its roof so he could lie under the bonnet in the shade. The cab was wrapped in black plastic sheet. A bundle of hunting spears poked out from one window. We sat down cross-legged in the sand. I asked him if he'd mind pointing out some local dreamings.
"Ho, ho," he broke into a wheezy cackle. "Many dreamings, many."
"Well, who?" I asked, waving towards Mount Liebler. "Who is that?"
"Ho, ho," he said. "That one a big one, a walk one, a parenti one."
The parenti, or lace monitor, is the largest lizard in Australia. It can reach a length of 8 feet or more, and has a burst of speed to run down a horse. Joshua stuck his tongue in and out like a lizard, and, twisting his fingers into claws, dug them crab-wise into the sand to imitate the parenti's walk. I looked up again at the cliff line of Mount Liebler and found I could read into the rock the lizard's flat triangular head, his shoulder, his foreleg and hind leg, and the tail tapering away towards the north.
"Yes," I said, "I see him.
So where was this parenti man coming from?"
"Come long way," said Joshua. "Come long, long way. Some way up Kimberley."
"And where's he going on to?" He raised his hand towards the south.
"Out that country, people."
Having established that the Parenti songline followed a north-south axis, I then swiveled round and pointed to Mount Cullen. "Okay," I said. "Who's this one?"
"Women,"
Joshua whispered.
"Two women."
He told the story of how the two women had chased Parenti up and down the country until, at last, they cornered him here and attacked his head with digging sticks. Parenti, however, had dug himself into the earth and escaped. A hole on the summit of Mount Liebler, like a meteorite crater, was all that remained of the head wound. South of Cullen, the country was green after the storms. There were isolated rocks jutting out of the plain like islands. "Tell me, Joshua," I asked, "who are those rocks over there?" Joshua listed fire, spider, wind, grass, porcupine, snake, old man, two men, and an unidentifiable animal, like a dog, but a white one. His own dreaming, the porcupine, or echidna, came down from the direction of Arnhem Land through Cullen itself and on towards Kalgoorlie. I looked back again towards the settlement, at the metal roofs and the spinning sails of the wind pump. "So porcupine's coming up this way," I said.
"Same one, boss,"
Joshua smiled.
"You seeing him good?"
He traced the line of the porcupine track across the airstrip, past the school and the pump, then on along the foot of the Parenti cliff before it swooped down onto the plain. "Can you sing him for me?" I asked. "Can you sing him coming up this way?" He glanced round to make sure no one was in earshot, and then, in his chesty voice, sang a number of porcupine couplets, keeping time by flicking his fingernail against a piece of cardboard sheet. "Thank you," I said.
"Boss."
"Tell me another story," I said.
"You like them stories?"
"I like them."
"Okay, boss."
He tilted his head from side to side.
"Story about the big fly one."
"Dragonfly?" I asked.
"Bigger one."
"Bird?"
"Bigger."
Aboriginals, when tracing a song line in the sand, will draw a series of lines with circles in between. The line represents a stage in the ancestors' journey, usually a day's march. Each circle is a stop, waterhole, or one of the ancestors' campsites. But the story of the big fly one was beyond me. It began with a few straight sweeps, then it wound into a rectangular maze, and finally ended in a series of wiggles. As he traced each section, Joshua kept calling a refrain in English.
"Ho, ho, they got the money over there."
I must have been very dim-witted that morning. It took me ages to realize that this was a Qantas dreaming. Joshua had once flown into London. The maze was London Airport, the arrival gate, health, immigration, customs, and then the ride into the city on the underground. The wiggles were the twists and turns of the taxi, from the tube station to the hotel. In London, Joshua had seen all the usual sights, the Tower of London, changing of the guard, and so on, but his real destination had been Amsterdam. The ideogram for Amsterdam was even more perplexing. There was a circle, there were four smaller circles around it, and there were wires from each of these circles which led to a rectangular box. Eventually it dawned on me that this was some kind of round table conference, at which he, Joshua, had been one of four participants. The others, in a clockwise direction, had been a white one, a father one, a thin one, a red one, a black one, a fat one. I asked if the wires were microphone cables. Joshua shook his head vigorously. He knew all about microphones. They had microphones on the table.
"No, no,"
he shouted, pointing his fingers at his temples. "Were they electrodes or something?"
"Hey,"
he cackled.
"You got him."
The picture I pieced together, true or false, I can't begin to say, was of a scientific experiment at which an Aboriginal had sung his dreaming. A Catholic monk had sung the Gregorian chant, a Tibetan Lama had sung his mantras, and an African had sung whatever, all four of them singing their heads off to test the effect of different song cycles on the rhythmic structure of the brain. The episode struck Joshua in retrospect as so unbelievably funny that he had to hold his stomach for laughing. So did I. We laughed ourselves into hysterics and lay gasping for breath on the sand. Weak from laughter, I got to my feet. I thanked him and said goodbye. He grinned.
"Couldn't you buy a man a drink?"
he growled in his John Wayne accent. "Not at Cullen," I said.